The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
24 hours a day, 7 days a week. The news never stops. Life goes on around town and around the world. You need a talk show that keeps track of it. A program with bold opinions that's always open to your views. That is this show. Welcome to the Mark Davis Show on 660 AM. The Answer.
All right, welcome. 866-660-5759. It is hour number two. On this Wednesday, the 10th of April, bottom of this hour, whatever we're doing, we'll hit a pause button on it, talk to Michael Waller, who's written a book called Big Intel, How the CIA and the FBI Went from Cold War Heroes to Deep State Villains. Yeah, this is just in the category of stories that involve our institutions just going into the crapper. You know, folks used to be able to admire, and of course we totally still admire, CIA agents, FBI agents. We don't have an agent problem. We don't have a rank and file problem. We have a management problem, leadership problem, corporate suite problem, and Big Intel dives into that, and so that'll be 8:35. Between now and then, we've lit quite the fire under the story of the parents. The parents. James and Jennifer Crumbly. Parents of their 15-year-old son who shot up a school, and they apparently ignored all kinds of warning signs. That's bad. That's negligent. And now for the first time, that's criminal. I mean, not just aiding and abetting criminal, manslaughter criminal. 10 to 15 years. And I've been one of those people who for years and years have been saying, you know, when a kid does something terrible, I'm like the first guy, like not just in talk show life, but real life, to go, where are the parents? What are the parents doing or not doing? I've said that anecdotally. I've said it seriously. I mean, I'm not kidding. Where are the parents? It's always a great question. But when the parents are found to have really dropped the ball, what do you actually do has always been kind of an open-ended question. Well, now, here's an answer. Here's an answer. Out of Oxford, Michigan, where a judge has sentenced both parents to 10 to 15 years. It's getting mostly approval. I think it gets mostly approval from me. But there's just some nagging little voice in my head that says, okay, the precedent value of this is murky and mysterious. It's like, okay, what? At some point, there'll be a harder case, a way harder case, where maybe, because listen, it's so much 2020 hindsight. In this particular case, really obvious. There'll be cases that aren't that obvious. And then you throw in, maybe it's part of parental love. I don't know. You never want to think the worst of your kid. Yeah, Billy's really shrewd up, but I didn't think he'd do that. I mean, how many times have you heard that? From the Viascan of Las Colinas text line, I'm not defending Ethan's parents, but I will say dealing with a mentally ill child is really difficult. One of my friends had a kid who was suicidal. She begged one hospital to take her son for observation. They didn't. He killed himself that night. We have a mentally ill child. We don't think they would hurt somebody, but we're very concerned about self-harm. Kids had issues since elementary school, we were told. That the condition wasn't bad enough to warrant help from school, so we paid money for psychiatrists, counselors. Most have given up on the child because they would sit in the car, refuse to go. Counselor would tell me, can't be forced, but I still owed the money. Child's now an adult. Virtually no affordable solutions to help. Needs to be more help for mentally ill people because the road is not easy. Wow, thank you. Appreciate that. And so before I hop into some more of the details on this, I just couldn't restrain myself from making a larger point, extrapolating out where this might go, that if we are going to start finding people responsible, criminally responsible, for not stopping people under their control, like parents and kids, how about district attorneys and criminals? How about attorneys general and state-level criminals? The degree to which they are let out, underpunished, early release, forgiven, not prosecuted at all. Soros prosecutors with soft-on-crime penalties, and then people get out and kill and maim. We're going to lock up some of those people for their oversight? Huh? I think on that strain of thought in Dallas, Leland, hey, happy Wednesday. How are you?
Doing well. How are you doing?
Good, thank you.
So I've got two points or two questions. Mm-hmm. One, I will echo your sentiment about what happens to, like, New York, where they had, what, 1,300 people were responsible for 75% of all the crimes that, or 70,000 crimes that occurred in the city. Mm-hmm. So, yes, those people who are letting the people out after multiple crimes should be held criminally liable. If that's the case, if this is the precedent being set, I think they should be held criminally liable. And, you know, look into the cities. Are we doing the same thing here, you know, in Dallas? But the second question point was, you know, as much as we like movies, the Tom Cruise movies, Minority Report,
yep.
Was a kid ever convicted of any type of crime or anything like that nature? I don't know the details
no.
of the specifics.
No, he did not have a rap sheet at 15. No.
Yeah. So I don't know if we can charge him with pre-crime, but, you know, that is one of the thoughts of, you know, what do we, we're almost at a place where someone has to commit a crime before we can really, you know, stop them from what they're doing.
Okay, totally true. And for those that aren't familiar, go get Minority Report. It's the notion of future crime, where we have technology, where we can see into the future, where people who are going to commit crime, so we just go and arrest them now. Wow, such a system. It's obviously fraught with ethical issues. In this particular case, he did shoot up the school. And so he was convicted for what he did. And the parents have now been convicted for what they, I guess, did not do. So let me go ahead and share some detail on this. Leland, thank you very, very much. Appreciate it. So these are, of course, the first parents to be held criminally responsible for a mass school shooting. The judge is a woman named Cheryl Matthews, and she told the families of the victims she could never understand their pain, but assured them she saw what you saw and heard what you heard at these trials. And she said these convictions confirm repeated acts or lack of acts that could have halted an oncoming runaway train. It's about repeatedly ignoring things that made a reasonable person feel the hair on the back of their neck stand up. Opportunity knocked over and over again, louder and louder, and was ignored. No one answered. And these two people should have and did not. Judge Matthews said the dad, James Crumbly, provided unfettered access to a gun as well as ammo in your home. And Jennifer Crumbly glorified the use and possession of these weapons. I glorify the use and possession of firearms every day. Of course, I don't have a mentally ill kid. Boy. The mom said, I sit here today to express my deepest sorrows for the family of Hannah, Tate, Madeline, Justin. Those are the kids their son killed. And to all those affected. The date of this was November 30th, 2021. The mom said, I'm not here to ask for your forgiveness. I know it may be beyond reach, but express my sincerest apologies. I will be in my own internal prison for the rest of my life. Right. That's what everybody says. I'll be in the prison of my mind. Yeah, I'm not going to be in a prison with bars. James Crumbly said, before I address the court directly, I want to do something I've never been able to do. I want to say I can't imagine the pain and agony for the families. Why have you not been able to do that before? The dad was apparently a total tool. He copped attitude all the time. Mouthed off about the judge, just not good, not good. So at the trial, prosecutors used testimony from survivors, police investigators, school employees, to show that these parents were just grossly negligent in allowing their teenage son to have access to the gun and ignoring signs of his steep mental health decline. It showed that the dad, James Crumbly, purchased the firearm for his son on Black Friday. And the next day, mom takes him to the range. Mom and son day testing out his new Christmas present, she wrote, after it on social media. Then the parents failed to properly secure the firearm. James Crumbly hid it in their bedroom, didn't use any locking device. In addition, the trials focused on a pivotal meeting between school employees, Ethan and his parents, on the morning of the shooting. Ethan had been called into the school office once after he made disturbing writings on a math worksheet, including the phrases, blood everywhere, and my life is useless, and drawings of a gun and a bullet. This is just like Sebastian Maniscalco. It's just like, hello, your kid's got 16 bazookas in the house. dressed up like Darth Vader, like, I don't know, what in the world happened? The school employees recommended the parents immediately take him out of class and get him some mental health treatment. And they said, can't do it, got to go to work. The Crumleys also did not mention to the school the recent gun purchase. So after that, Ethan was sent back to class. About 2 hours later, takes the gun out of his backpack, opens fire at the school. So the mom blamed the husband, the school, and her son for the shooting while expressing no regret of her own. She said, I've asked myself if I would have done anything differently, and I wouldn't have. Oh, that's a good move, Jennifer. By contrast, the dad, James Crumley, did not testify. Probably smart. So there we are. There we are. 4 counts of involuntary manslaughter. Here's the judge.
Parents are not expected to be psychic. But these convictions are not about poor parenting. These convictions confirm repeated acts or lack of acts that could have halted an oncoming runaway train. About repeatedly ignoring things that would make a reasonable person feel the hair on the back of their neck stand up.
So Jesse had on this Judge Elizabeth Scherer, who was the judge in the Parkland case, and asked her if this seemed reasonable to her.
Elizabeth Scherer joins me now. Elizabeth, do you think legally this is a sound ruling?
Absolutely. For years, Jesse, when I worked as a prosecutor for 10 years in violent crimes, and then I was a judge for 10 years, something like this used to be termed felony stupidity. In other words, you have this parent who's got a kid that's doing something extremely alarming, and the parents just got their head in the sand, not doing anything to prevent what could easily be a preventable tragedy. I think that this was a sound ruling, and I think that this sets a precedent that parents cannot be stupid anymore. You have
good luck with that. However, deterrent value, I guess, right? If you're a parent and you got a kid drawing disturbing stuff, you know, or, you know, my life is useless. So, you know, I'm going to shoot up school. Here's, you know, I'm got 14 trench coats in my closet. Maybe you don't overlook that anymore. Is that partially the message of these verdicts, is to wake parents up from coast to coast?
So you have rights as a parent. You have constitutional rights to bear arms. But with those rights come responsibility. And these people and all parents owe it to the community to exercise those responsibilities with those rights.
Elizabeth Scherer, the judge in the Parkland case. We are in Burleson. Angela, Mark Davis, welcome. How are you?
Howdy.
Hey.
Great. Thanks for taking my call. Sure. I see people in my office weekly as a psychologist, mm-hmm. who are parents of children that have developmental delays, and they will come to me the child is maybe 4, 5, 6 years old, and people have been telling them for a while, you know, I think maybe something is wrong with your child. They don't seem to be talking. They don't seem to be making eye contact, whatever the case may be. Parents often, not all, but often will stick their head in the sand, as you pointed out, or the judge pointed out. They stick their head in the sand. They hope it's not true. In this case, though, it seems so blatant that the things that were going on were so incredibly over the line. There's just hardly a way to justify them not seeking help for him.
I know, but you've just described exactly the part of human nature that you know well, and I just know from being a person out in the world, and that is, you've heard the old adage, we see what we want to see. We can also ignore what we wish to ignore. We have a willful blindness. No parent wants to come to the sad admission that you got a broken kid, or a crazy kid, or a disturbed kid, or a potentially homicidal kid. No, that's a pretty uncomfortable road to walk. So there'll be all kinds of denial, all kinds of willful blindness.
And the sad thing about it is we want to demonize the people who are in that situation, walking that road, and they have a child, like you said, that's you know, we don't use the word broken in our profession necessarily,
yeah.
But a child that has developmental delays or has mental health issues of any sort, you want your child to have a full and a full life and experience all the things that you want them to experience, that anyone wants to experience. But when you have a child that is that off the rails, they are Teflon and they won't lose.
Yeah. Exactly. All right. So as a last thing, as a professional, are you comfortable or uncomfortable with every once in a while a court sending parents away for 10 to 15 years for that willful blindness?
Yeah, I don't know how comfortable I am with it. I understand why it's important and we've got to do something about it, because you can't just, in the United States, we want to blame. We want to lay blame at people's feet.
Yep.
And when you admit that your child has something wrong with them, then people want to say, oh, well, that was your fault. What did you do as a parent that created this child? How were you responsible? Was it your genetics? Was it the way you nurtured your child or didn't nurture your child? All of those things. So you have to accept blame if you're saying something's wrong with your child.
What a because part of it is the human nature of not wanting to look at this child that you love, that you brought into the world, as being as having flaws, perhaps criminal flaws. You know, nobody wants to reach that. But also, for the parent who does step forward and say, hey, I have a deeply troubled kid, and you invariably the question will be, oh, really? What did you do wrong? Angela, thank you so much. I'm deeply, deeply grateful. 824. Mickey Thomas and Grace Slick, they're long gone.
Find your way back.
Little Find Your Way Back from Modern Times. So they'll do that. And Jane. And I think Somebody to Love, old Jefferson Airplane record. But do stand warned, they will do one of the most dreadful songs ever recorded, We Built This City. So just stand warned, you may want to be out getting a beer at that point tonight at Longhorn Ballroom, Jefferson Starship, and Dave Mason. Can I get, do me a favor, everybody sit tight. We are waist deep in fascinating stuff on the kids' parents getting 10 to 15 years for just real serious criminal negligence. Let me pause, come back after the news. I got to talk to this guy who's going to tell us how the FBI and CIA, went into the crapper reputationally, how they went from Cold War heroes to deep state villains. Talk to him for just a few minutes, and then I'm going to come right back to you. Sound good? So everybody just sit tight. Got lots going on. We can keep the plate spinning. It is Wednesday, April 10th. Mark Davis, 831. Nikki Whaley is in the newsroom. Wednesday show in progress. Lots going on topically speaking. Back to your calls on a variety of things here in a second, but let's add another layer because I have been looking forward to this. Quick, what are some of the most serious problems we have today? I could do 14 shows on that. What are some of the biggest, craziest problems we have today? Some of them are categorizable under the heading of things we used to trust, we just can't anymore. The judiciary is weaponized and all kinds of institutions, don't get me started on the media. But even the stuff that I grew up, I'm a kid of the Cold War. And so, and my dad was in the Air Force and had sort of a tangential connection with military intelligence. And you talk about the CIA and the FBI. And by the way, the people who are still walking the halls of those buildings and in those organizational charts as agents, they are heroes among us. But from the management, how did they get weaponized? How is the CIA? How do you get John Brennan? How do you get James Comey? How does that even happen? It has been a stain on the reputation of the CIA and the FBI. And as I said before, if you put the adjective big in front of something, big media, big Hollywood, it can only be bad. That's why it is a very instructive title, Big Intel, How the CIA and FBI Went from Cold War Heroes to Deep State Villains. Michael Waller, the author, is a former operative for the CIA. We'll ask about that. And a counterintelligence expert has done much for the Center for Security Policy. Mr. Waller, welcome. How you doing?
Doing great, Mark.
Very nice to have you. Give me the resume, what you did. What does CIA operative mean? What did you do?
Well, it was a pretty unorthodox one. So I wasn't a CIA employee. So I wasn't an officer. But I worked for CIA Director Bill Casey in a network that he was funding out of his pocket so he wouldn't have to report it to Congress or testify about it because it was his own money and his own business. And this was to collect intelligence south of the border on how the Soviet Union was funding communist insurgencies right down south of Mexico.
Wow.
And for some reason, the CIA intelligence collectors couldn't make those links to the Soviet support. So they had amateurs like us go down and do the job.
Did you succeed?
Oh, yeah. We brought in a lot of physical material and pictures and documents and then other accounts that the embassy could handle. But what we were doing at the time was really unorthodox. And I got my cryptonym in church so that nobody at the CIA or Casey personally, who was at mass, who whispered to me my cryptonym and then walked away, he would never have to testify before Congress because you can't be compelled to testify about what went on in church.
I love learning words. Is a cryptonym a code name?
Yes.
Whoa.
Yeah, okay. So that was my code. I was given a code name that I thought was a name of somebody else to ask for when I went down to Central America, but actually I was that person. Gotcha. Took me a long time to learn that.
So you've seen how these things operate and then have done some think tank stuff and some scholarship stuff, and the Soviet Union comes to an end, and that's certainly a good. And the CIA is supposed to be good, and the FBI is supposed to be good. Do you share my setup that these agents are salt of the earth heroes, often victimized by the corruption in the management suites? Do I have that right, that the problems you describe tend to be managerial rather than rotten apples in the ranks?
Well, you know, any human endeavor is going to have its faults, so we just have to accept all of that. But you're right; it's really the management that became corrupted in two ways. It's a moral corruption, both ways. But the first one is careerism, where they put career ahead of mission. And actually, I was discouraged from actually joining the CIA as a CIA officer, because even at the time in the early 80s, I was told that people who are mission oriented will be very unhappy working, making a career in the CIA. So it becomes careerist, and they're looking out for their careers first. But what happened since really the Obama administration was, you combine that careerism and the mediocrity that comes with it with ideological orthodoxy. And this is where the political correctness and critical theory and wokeness come in, where it's not just sort of new people coming in with different attitudes or ideas, but it's an enforced orthodoxy that if you do not go along with it, and if you do not believe that 2 + 2 = 5, you will not be promoted in the system and your career is effectively ruined.
Is this recent?
It took place really after 9/11, when there was it was under President George W. Bush, when there was a huge hiring of a lot of new intelligence personnel, and they weren't carefully screened. I was a graduate professor at the time at a small school in D.C., and we were a feeder school to the intelligence community. And I was even telling some of the background investigators, don't hire this particular person. It's just a rotten apple who's too ideological to be an objective person in intelligence. But they were hiring people left and right, and especially in the tech sector. So they brought in techies with their San Francisco values who really didn't believe in America or its founding principles or the our constitutional system. They believed in whatever stuff that they happened to believe in, and diversity became the buzzword. And if you were against that and all the ideological connotations behind their peculiar definition of this, you were a bad person. And then later on, in recent years, that has turned into what they call a domestic threat.
Oh, yes, indeed. Complain at your kid's school and you're a domestic terrorist. Michael Waller is here. The book is Big Intel, How the CIA and FBI Went from Cold War Heroes to Deep State Villains. Clearly, there's house cleaning that needs to take place. I would love to think that a good cleansing presidency by Donald Trump, since it looks like he's going to be the guy, could take care of this. Yet, you know, that sort of, you know, mend it, don't end it. But then you get, I think it was the, well, there are some folks, I think Vivek and some other folks in, who've said, no, you just got to destroy it twig by branch and start from scratch. Which do you think is true?
Well, we can't start from scratch because we need an intelligence community. We you know, we're the number one target of all the bad guys in the world, like it or not. And we need a counterintelligence service like the FBI performs. And we need federal law enforcement to the extent there are federal laws to enforce. So we need what these agencies are supposed to do. But you mentioned house cleaning. I would mention it more sort of a total renovation down to the bones and then start over. But you don't just not live in a house just because your house needs to be redone. You pull out the parts that can be salvaged. You make them work. You remove a lot of the positions where there are bad personnel. So you can't fire these people, right? But you can abolish their positions, and then they have to leave federal service if they don't get another job. So if you simply pulled out, say, anybody involved with diversity, equity, and inclusion, all of those positions are now abolished. The president can do that with an executive order. So that's one way to start a house cleaning or a renovation. So even Vivek had an idea of how to do it. It's a very businesslike idea, but there are more specific ways where he was more randomly go every other type of personnel, get rid of a position. He's on to something there, but a better way to be, let's look at the functions. What do we need and what we don't need? We don't need secret intelligence to spy on the climate.
Yes, you are correct about it. And in fact, it leads me to my last question. It'll be, you know, January 20th of 2025 before we can even have hope of dealing with this at the executive level. So in the meantime, in an admittedly deeply dangerous world, filled with bad people, filled with bad actors, how concerning is it or should it be that the CIA and FBI, who are both trying to do, I believe, so many guys and gals trying to do good jobs every day, how much of a distraction is it when they are concerned more about irrelevancies in the woke world and in the modern world?
Oh, it benefits the bad guys. Imagine you have counterintelligence officers who've been taken off Russian and Chinese spy cases, counterterrorism officers who've been taken off jihadist and Iranian terror cases, people taken off child trafficking and sex trafficking investigations to go after misdemeanor allegations against hundreds, if not thousands, of people who protested, not even committed crimes, but protested on January 6th. So they've got a complete distraction away from that and a fake narrative that there's a huge white supremacist underground out there that's infiltrated our military. Well, no. You know, there was a group called the Boogaloo. Remember the Boogaloo threat that the FBI was warning about?
Yeah.
The Boogaloo boys. Well, no. So now all of a sudden, after Hamas attacked Israel on October 7th, the FBI director comes out and says, well, this kind of terrorism is the biggest danger we face. Well, duh, it has been all along. It was just a political decision to direct the FBI and the rest of the intelligence community away from those threats. So we've been left unprotected.
J. Michael Waller. The book is Big Intel, How the CIA and FBI Went from Cold War Heroes to Deep State Villains. Thank you, sir, for your service to the country and for your service to all of us in the pages of the book. Appreciate meeting you.
Great to be with you, Mark.
That is Michael Waller. Big Intel. Big Intel, How the CIA and FBI Went from Cold War Heroes to Deep State Villains. Alrighty, 848. All right, they're sticking parents in jail for what the kid did, and some additional angles on the phones and your thoughts and some additional info from me on this. We'll wrap this up by 9, head in some other directions the 9 o'clock hour. Many, many things to address on this Wednesday, April 10th. Mark Davis, 660 a.m. The Answer. More of you are next. Well, if it's Concert Calendar Wednesday, where we're hipping you to who's coming to town.
It was Labor Day weekend. I was 17. I bought a Coke and some gasoline.
Little Tim McGraw at Dickies Arena, Fort Worth.
When I saw her for the
Friday
first
night.
Time, she was standing there in the ticket line.
Seats still available, especially on the secondary market. Little something like that from 1999. McGraw's great. McGraw is so good. Just a wonderful, wonderful show. All right, 866-660-5759. Okay, so parental ignorance no longer a defense. The era of, I just had no idea what my kid was capable of doing. That's over. Yet there is an undercurrent of some unease from some of you about, okay, if Ethan Crumbly's parents' case might be a pretty easy one, there are other cases that won't be, and are we going to have some people locked up for stuff that's just 2020 hindsight, where, I mean, you got to walk in the shoes of people with troubled kids, and there's, so it's been an interesting discussion, and it continues. We're in Little Elm. Steve, Mark Davis, welcome. How are you?
Thanks, Mark.
Hey.
First-time caller.
Thank you.
Have listened for a long time. Yeah. So I have a question. I'm a former litigator back in a prior life, and did anyone dare to look in Ethan's backpack when everyone was talking to him at school?
Clearly no, or they would have found the gun.
Right. I mean, that's the negligence, right?
I guess. I mean, how many times is there a troubled kid in the principal's office and the parents are called in and there's disturbing stuff going on? You know, is the bar always met where we go rifling through the kid's backpack? Always?
Only if he has risen to the level of drawing a gun, talking about blood everywhere. I mean, like you said,
that
you
is true. That is
unique
true.
Fact.
It's not like he said, "Ooh, I'm sad." There was gun imagery
right.
All over the place. Yeah, I'd like to have that one back, Steve. Thank you. Appreciate it very much. And give us a call again. I hope you will anytime soon. Lake Highlands, Rob, Mark Davis, welcome. How are you?
Hey, Mark. Talk
Hi.
About going on after, you know, various acts and Chill and Thunder. First, best bumpers ever. So, parents of shooters. It's about responsibility,
mm-hmm.
period. Right? And it, as in, who is responsible for what?
Mm-hmm.
Your 14-year-old grabs the spare keys and runs over the neighbor's mailbox.
Yeah.
You're responsible, right? So that's the difference. I'm going to distinguish. That's the civil responsibility.
Really?
Because a 14-year-old is not paying for it.
Right. So if I left the keys out on the counter of my house and my 14-year-old is a jackwagon and grabs the keys and goes, does something terrible. I mean, I'm financially responsible because the kid ain't got no money.
But, exactly. That's the civil responsibility.
Okay. Gotcha. All right.
Now, so the question here is, what rises to criminal negligence mm-hmm. responsibility, mm-hmm. right?
Right.
So personally, I think this is a milestone, and I totally understand why a lot of people are super scoochy about it.
Yeah.
Right?
Our great state,
there's a criminal penalty for making available a weapon to a minor. Period.
Right, okay.
Availability, right?
So,
we can, who should have seen, who should have done what, who should have, whatever. I bought the kid a gun,
yep.
Took him to the range,
right.
Knowing full well what those risk factors were.
Because you got a really deeply disturbed kid. This is not like me taking Ethan to Eagle Gun Range and shooting guns with David Prince.
No.
Yeah.
I'm a proud parent of three functional 30-year-old boys.
Yep.
Okay. I get that. I get that. But at some point, there's the threshold we discuss, I think.
Yeah.
Where are you criminally mm-hmm. negligent?
And I guess juries will just have to figure this out, and judges will just have to figure this out. And you know, we won't. The line will be easier to recognize than describe. But at some point, there's going to be some case where the talk show is about, do these people really deserve? I mean, do they deserve it at all? I think with these parents totally deserve to be pilloried. Totally. If there was like aiding and abetting and, you know, lock them up for a year, we wouldn't be doing this show. But 10 to 15 for manslaughter? I was like, okay, all right, I'm asking. Appreciate it, sir. Thank you. And I guess I'll continue to ask. This is popular. So I'll do this. I'll add some other layers as the 9 o'clock hour unfolds before us on this Wednesday, April 10th. Mark Davis, 859. Everybody stick around.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.